Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. And with our partners at the Urbanite, we produce every month several shows that come out of that magazine, shows that we try to bring to life the articles that have been written, bring people in who the articles were about, and that is what is happening in this first part of our program here on the Mark Steiner Show, WEAA. We are going to talk with folks who are part of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That was part of an article in the Urbanite magazine. They've been on the show before in many transformations. Some were here earlier in their days as high school students in the Urban Debate Leagues. And they've been here on the show as leaders of a beautiful struggle. I'll let them describe that movement for you in a moment themselves. We're joined in studio by Davon Love, who is president of the LBS, Shauna Murray, vice president for outreach for leaders, and Deverick Murray, who is vice president of programming. And welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Once again. So tell our listeners who may not have met you, heard about you, know about you, who are the leaders of a beautiful struggle and what is the leaders of a beautiful struggle.
I guess
I'll
start.
Davon?
Yeah, I'll start.
Congratulations on your run for city council, Davon.
Thank you.
You ran a magnificent campaign,
which
we'll talk a little bit about.
I will.
Good campaign.
My name is Davon Love. I'm in my last semester at Towson University. I'm also a teacher at Connections Academy. I teach African American studies and I teach debate. Most of what I have done in terms of the work that I've done in the community and what LBS has started to do stems from the work I did as a debater, starting with the Baltimore Urban Debate League, which teaches young people about issues of public policy. And so I did it in college. I got a scholarship to go to Towson University to debate. I was fortunate enough in 2008 to win a national championship, the first team of black debaters to do so, return to finals my senior year, top speaker debater of the year. And with those skills, one of the things that I said to myself is, what could I do with these skills that I got from this activity? Which I think is an activity that makes people smarter faster than any other academic activity there is. And so I figured, why not start an organization where we can connect young people to public policy and get them involved in things that can help improve the quality of life while mentoring young people and giving them a sense of social and political consciousness. I did run for city council in the 8th District, came in third place. I learned a lot, developed some really good relationships, and it was an extension of the work LBS is doing in incorporating advocacy for young people into the realm of public policy. That's pretty much it for me.
So tell me what you all do with LBS. What are your functions inside the organization?
I am the vice president of outreach, so my role is to outreach to our communities. I'm really trying to get the young people, the parents, involved in understanding what LBS does by inviting them to our freedom forums and then other political events that we may be having.
How you doing?
Good, Deverick. Welcome.
Deverick Murray. I also teach Lakeland Elementary Middle School. My part in Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle is that I'm the vice president of programming, which pretty much means I deal with all logistics of any events that we have. I deal with any volunteers, marketing, promotion of any events, and, pretty much the day of what's going on in any type of event, whether it be food, whether it be, microphones, those type of things. Anything going on with the event that day is pretty much what my job is.
Just for a second, let me take a step back, and then I'm going to jump into some key questions here. And folks, you can join us at any time you're ready at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I was wondering about the debating stuff that you all did, the two of you did, in college and high school. And how, in some ways, urban debate leagues transformed not just the two of y'all, not just people who are in it, but transformed the nature of debate. Because what you all did in debate was to bring in not just your intellectual power and your powers of research and persuasion and argument, but you brought in this kind of this sense of this body of kind of African American culture into the mix of a debate that, in many ways, people weren't prepared for.
Yeah.
is that a fair statement?
Yeah, a part of what we've done, one of the things that a phrase that we used a lot as debaters was this phrase that most people use culture as a reference and not a resource. Mm-hmm. So for us, culture was a resource for the development of the intellectual methods that we deployed in debate. I won nationals with an argument called the Black aesthetic. We said the debate community was saturated in a white aesthetic, centered on European principles that didn't fit the lifestyles nor the ethos of the essential African consciousness that people like Asa Hilliard and Naeem Akbar and Karenga, the folks like that, talk about. Devrick actually was really successful with an argument called Nomo. It's an argument that talks about the importance of the word in African cultural traditions, and that the word being synonymous with that which gives life, and understanding the constraints of Western rhetorical limitations, that those restraints oftentimes confine people of color in institutions or environments that don't allow them to understand themselves in their own terms. And Devrick can tell you a little bit about some of the things that he did.
How did that manifest itself, especially in debate form? How did it manifest itself?
Well, specifically how Nomo manifested itself in a debate would be, we would do simple little things like rewrite another team's plan in Ebonics, right? So a standard plan in a debate round would be like, the United States federal government should substantially decrease subsidies for like
wheat
or corn or something of that nature.
Right.
And we would simply, you know, use USFG, you know what I'm saying, and take the acronym and make it, you know, something ridiculous. Or, you know, we would say the something that you would hear on any corner in Baltimore City, the Federales, you know what I mean? Same things in that sort of manner. We saying the exact same thing that this young student from Northwestern is saying, but we saying it in Ebonics, and all of a sudden, nobody in the room understands what we're talking about.
So how did that? So what happened then?
So then we would make an argument that the same way that they didn't understand what we were saying is how we felt when we first introduced to the program. When you come in and you have all the specific debate jargon like permutation, you know, which to anybody sounds completely absurd, a permutation, you know what I'm saying? What's other words that
like, you know, these, you know, fancy jargon with counterplans, dispositionality, mm-hmm. conditionality, you know, just all these fancy jargon that you have to go spend $7,000 for 6 weeks at Michigan to learn, that students that go to these fancy private schools around the country pay for in order to compete.
Right. And so, you know, though, then you have a situation in a room where debaters are talking to a judge, and the judge understands. There's five people in the room, and only three people are having a conversation, because the two debaters from our Urban Debate League not necessarily understand, because they don't go to those camps. They aren't privileged enough to be able to have time or to have the money and resources to go to those camps, so we left out on the bubble. When we started to get the higher and higher we got up into the ranks of the open division of debate, you know, it was understood on the judge's behalf between us when we learned the jargon and we started to, you know, take like permutation. I always say, every time I try to teach students what a permutation is, they think about a perm, you know, like from a hairstyle, like, oh, my mutated. You know what I'm saying? So we called it a hothead, right? So we would call a permutation a hothead, right? Denzel Washington, the conk, burning his head. That's why we called it a hothead. And judges are sitting back thinking about what we're talking about, and it's really transforming the way that they understand how we heard words and what that meant to us. We called ourselves rehumanizing a dead language, you know, Western rhetoric. And basically, the other teams then would be left out of the conversation, and it would be something for them to understand that this is what happens on both sides. It's something that we need to account for in the debate community.
I just want to give people a sense of that, because I think that people don't realize how I've been covering the urban debate leagues since I was on their board back in the 90s when it all began, and watched these changes and watched young people like yourselves back then who were taking these debates and how it was transforming them, how it was transforming their schools. It was also transforming the entire notion of debate. And it's a pretty amazing process. I think people don't really get a sense of how that's how important that is to our school systems to have these debate leagues inside of them, even though it's getting harder and harder because principals saying we can't afford them.
Right. I mean, I think the other thing that's important is also the notion that students can self-direct their educational experience. I think in many instances, students are confined in schools to their educational trajectory being defined by an education system that doesn't take in consideration their experiences, their own special needs culturally, socially, politically. And so debate, along with many other activities, but debate in our case is something that allowed us to self-direct our own educational trajectory.
410-319-8888. Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle are in the studio. You've just been listening to Dave on Love and Deverick Murray. Shauna Murray is here as well. All three leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. So let me ask you this other question. And folks, I want you to join us here. This is something that people are always saying. We don't hear the voices of our younger citizens on the media airwaves. Well, we do our best to change that. They're here. Whenever we hear the voices of young folks, especially young folks of color, in this community, on our media, it's always something on the negative end. Always, not always. Most of the time, it's something on a negative end, not a positive end. We try to switch that up here on the Steiner Show because it needs to be switched up because times have to change, and the folks at the studio here are some of the folks who are dealing with that change. Now, let me ask a question. What do you think happened in this last election? What do y'all think happened in this last Baltimore City election? Under that, you ran in Davon, and you ran a hard and interesting kind of media campaign in the thing. You came in third, but did really well, I thought. You know, 21 years old, never ran a campaign before, still in college. What's your analysis, the three of you, about what happened in this campaign and why it seemed as if, even though there was an explosion of young candidates, all of whom did very well, one of whom upset a sitting candidate, one of whom almost upset, came like within a hair's breadth, just like less than a dozen votes of almost unseating another established candidate, Shannon Sneed. So what do you think happened, though, that status quo remained? Give me your analysis and maybe see if I can push a little bit. Go ahead, Shauna.
I could best start with the conversation I had with my grandmother. Whereas, you know, I'm like, Grandma, my best friend's running, you know, in your district. What's going on? What's up? And she's like, well, I think the lady know what she's doing, you know? You're young. You got time. And so, in a sense, I feel like, you know, many of us and kind of from the older generation, you know, felt like, you know, who does Davon Love think he is coming in here thinking that he's going to come and take these positions. He hasn't earned it yet.
Hasn't paid his dues yet.
Right, and they weren't ready. They weren't ready for Davon Love because when they saw him in person, they were like, oh, you know, the women, you know.
Don't let that go to Davon's head. Stop.
You know, but they were really impressed because they weren't prepared for what Davon had to offer. And then from the youth perspective, I think we've gone so long with young people feeling like there was no one that could speak to their issues, you know, that there was no one that really understood what was going on, that they didn't find the value in voting because the parents, you know, many of the parents in Baltimore City, many of whom I work with as a social worker, you know, they themselves haven't been voting because they felt like their issues weren't being spoken to. So they haven't taught their children the value of voting. I wasn't taught the value of voting until I went, you know, to college and really was kind of exposed to the role that played in my everyday life. So I feel like it's kind of both those two experiences kind of sandwiching on each other, which, you know, allowed for the very same thing to happen.
Your family historically did not vote. Is that what you're saying?
No, they didn't teach me not to vote.
I
just didn't teach me to vote.
To vote. I very clear.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, that goes on in Baltimore, and for some reason it doesn't get said often enough, there are cliques of people, politicos, pundits, and so forth, and many of them talk to each other. So what you have is that you have an insular community of so-called experts on black politics. And what happens is that they're so insular but create this illusion that they're connected to the people. Most of the people in this city are disconnected from politics and from its significance in their lives. And unfortunately, there isn't enough work done to stretch outside of those insular communities because, quite frankly, it's harder. You know, it's harder to talk to people who traditionally have not been involved in politics and to get them to be involved in it. And those are the people who probably are dissatisfied with the status quo, who would be more interested in seeing change in the city. But because, unfortunately, a lot of the people who will, you know, proclaim to be doing the work of empowering people in Baltimore who are suffering Unfortunately, you know, we go to the same events, you know, see each other at all the same activities, and don't make it a point to really reach out to people who, you know, I mean, it's hard work. It's hard work to get people who traditionally haven't been involved. And so I think that's the problem, the overall issue with the election, really. The reason why we had such low turnout, you know, it's because we're talking to each other. We were excited about all the different candidates that were in the race, you know, all the people who care and pay attention. But there wasn't nearly enough work done to captivate those who traditionally aren't paying attention.
Similarly, I believe that the people who are happy with what's going on in the city of Baltimore all vote. And, you know, they voted. They are okay. You know what I'm saying? They're taken care of. They've been eating. You know, their trash gets picked up. You know, all of those simple basic necessities of life are being taken care of. And they know that. They go vote to make sure that they can keep what they have. And I think that the people who are, you know, not being taken care of in the city are so disinterested in politics. I spent majority of my time in Emerson Village. I mean, I might have been in Emerson Village out of a 5-day week, 3 nights a week for 3 or 4 hours a night, and talk to so many people, you know what I'm saying? And so many people would say to me, yeah, this man Davon, he got my support. Y'all can put a sign up. Y'all can do this. It got the people talking about his name. People wanted Davon, right? But these are all the people who don't believe in politics, who don't believe that if they get up and what they would call waste their time to go vote, that things will change, because they did that 2-4 years ago. Nothing's different. They did that 8 years ago. They voted for Obama and they can't tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So they're dissatisfied with what voting has done for them before. And so they decide that it doesn't matter. So they don't vote. But all the people who are, you know, somewhat happy with the situation, who, you know, they're not, their lights aren't cut off. You know what I'm saying? Those are the people who are okay or happy with the situation. They voted. And so they kept the status quo because the status quo is benefiting them.
I have some more questions about that and some other issues as well. But let me open the phone to you so the listeners are thinking. 410-319-8888. You're listening to the voices of leaders of a beautiful struggle. Davon Love, Shauna Murray, and Debrick Murray. 410-319-8888. Donald, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. How is everyone?
Very well.
Good afternoon.
Good.
And I'd like to say to the young folks, y'all all are winners. Let no one tell you anything different. I was a part of the election process. I was working with Rhonda Winbish on her campaign. And what some of the young folks just expressed is 100% true. Those who have been taken care of got out and voted. And the people were so turned off of the political process because they didn't see anything come back their way. They didn't see the benefits of it for themselves. And what's very interesting is that no one wanted those who were of the political establishment, those that we, as the young folks said, that were the experts, they didn't want people going to the communities that they have basically wrote off and said, we don't have to go to those folks because those people don't vote. That has been the problem in this particular city, that they have written people off to the point that in areas like Park Heights and parts of West Baltimore, particularly in Park Heights, because that was part of the six councilmatic district, that you would have been surprised of the issues and the concerns that people had. And the problem is that the people that are sitting in office and have been there for the longest period of time, that there is a disconnect, and there always will be a disconnect. And the folks that did not vote, they did vote. And we condemn them for not turning out the vote. The problem is that the politicians of the establishment have turned them out, and that is a situation that has to change. All right. Well, I thank you very much.
Donald, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Let me ask this question. One of the things I thought about, and I think it was Donald was saying, then we'll go to Michael and Alex, the next two callers up. Sometimes I think that organizations, whether it maybe not yours, maybe yours. I don't know yet. I'll ask the question and see. But the Greens, many any group I can think of that wants to seek change in this city, in this country, is they spend so much time worrying about elections and less time about organizing people, getting people to understand the issues, organizing people so they stand up for themselves, and then maybe if there's an election, you can take over or at least push it. But you know, there's no, you can't just run in a vacuum.
Yeah, I think the problem is that you have a lot of politicians without a movement. You have a lot of movements without elected officials to represent them. And there needs to be a synergy between those elected officials and a movement connected to them. I think in certain ways, many of the people who are organizing alienate themselves from the political realm, and that many people who are in politics alienate themselves from those who are doing community organizing. But, I mean, that's a part of the hard work of, you know, building that bridge.
I mean, because I was thinking about the work that you do as a social worker. We were talking about a little bit before the show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I can remember back in the 60s, early 70s, 60s especially, there was groups like the Welfare Rights Organization, mm-hmm. of women who represent some of the clients that you would work mm-hmm. with, would mm-hmm. stand up politically and say, no, this is not the way you're going to handle my life. This is not what you can do to my children. This is not what people, and they were, poor people were organized to kind of stand up for their rights, and that created a base.
It did.
To build from that we don't have now.
It's true. Many of the clients that I work with on a day-to-day, they're so overwhelmed with how they're going to get to work or how they're going to get work or to make sure that their child has diapers. They don't spend the time really, they're not really interested at this point because they haven't been able to see how they can configure their lives to fit. They haven't been able to see how important and how it can work. And I just think that we need to be able to provide an opportunity for them to kind of look back and see where it's worked before to get them motivated again. And it takes a lot. I mean, Baltimore City is small, but it's also very big when you're on one block.
Yeah.
And you kind of, and it takes a long time to get, you know, the people in our communities to trust us. You know, they have to continue to see that you're not going to just get here. You're not going to just be here until you get what you want, that you're going to continue.
And disappear.
I think that they'll be excited to see that, you know, we remain.
Do you want to add that, Deborah? Really, go back to the phones?
I just, only thing I want to say is I would actually say, you know, we spent a lot more time
in the community,
organizing and in the community than we did campaigning. And I think that that was actually the biggest part of our campaigning. We started actual, like, political campaigning 90 days out. You know what I'm saying? We were way more interested in having our freedom forums, way more interested in getting people to come out to the mayoral forums. You know, we spent a lot more time on organizing people and educating people about what was going on than we actually did about putting Davon's name out to get votes. You know, so I just think that, you know, there is a strategy to be had where, you know, organizing is campaigning.
Let's hear what listeners have to say about all this. 410-319-8888 and more. Michael, you're on the air.
I couldn't agree with more with these brothers and sisters out here. Michael Scott, Equity Matters. We're thrilled.
Hey, Michael. By the way, Michael, I got your email saying I didn't ask the right questions the other night, so we'll have to talk about that.
Yes, we do. here's the thing. These folks did ask the right questions, and at their Freedom Forum on Health, it was spectacular. I'm talking about people at the congressional level, at the gubernatorial level that do not have the command and nuance of policy that these folks have, that you talk, these young folks have, that you're talking about. And it's not just that. It's, as you also heard, they're out in the community doing the work. The problem is that, you know, to make the two match, to make politicians understand as well as the community that has to pressure them and hold them accountable is hard work. And the problem with hard work is that it's hard and it's work. And, you know, I'm just excited about the movement that we're all creating together. Our commitment is to make sure that all the good stuff that we're seeing in communities on a national level filters back through to our learning community. And the young people are a key component of that. And, you know, we're looking to them for leadership, not token leadership, but real leadership, because they're already doing the work. And so, you know, the future looks bright because of the work that they're doing. And, you know, eventually this stuff cycles and catches up, right? And exactly what you're saying is going to happen is that this organizing around good policy, eventually good policy becomes good politics. And so we'll see that lag catch up. But I'm just thrilled with the work that they're doing, and the level of commitment and intelligence that they bring to the table is extraordinary.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah. Always good to hear from you. 410-319-8888. Alex, you're on the air.
Yes, I am a registered independent voter, lifelong Baltimore City resident, and a product of Baltimore City Public Schools. Most of the time when I vote, obviously I can't vote in the primary because I'm an independent. Not too happy about that, but it is what it is. I learned a long time ago that I am not very pleased with either of the two major political parties, and as I've gotten older, I'm 44 now, my attitude towards the two major political parties has been reinforced as I've gotten older. But I do applaud the younger folks for being involved and being committed to making a change for the better in my hometown, in my city. There are a lot of things about Baltimore that I love with a passion, but then there are other things that I equally despise and I'm displeased with an equal amount of passion. And that is crime, obviously. I came up in the 80s when the crack epidemic was at its peak. I just recently purchased a home in West Hills, and about a month after I moved into my home, as you may know, two young people were killed. And just prior to their murder, a police officer was shot no more than two blocks from my home.
Right.
I have a young 5-6-month-old son, and I am very concerned, obviously. Now, West Hills is not known for crime, but obviously I'm very concerned. If I choose to stay in the city, will I have to be worried about my son growing up and being an innocent victim of crime like those two young kids were? They were not involved in any type of criminal activity or gang-related activity, obviously. But I'm concerned about my son growing up and being an innocent victim of crime, just like these two kids were. So I have those concerns. And obviously, as a homeowner, having to pay higher taxes than any other jurisdiction in the entire state.
Right.
That's another one of my concerns, obviously, as well as the education system. My wife is not very pleased with Baltimore City Public Schools. They're getting better, but they're far from being adequate as far as I'm concerned.
So how would you, what would you like our guests to comment on?
I would like our guests to comment on specifically how they can influence the crime rate in the city, and also influence in a positive direction the taxes that, you know, homeowners or property owners have to pay, and lowering them to a reasonable level so that we don't have to be higher than every other jurisdiction in the entire state.
Question.
Yeah, I mean, two answers, at least as far as I'm concerned. The first one, we talk about organizing, so we need to develop a base where you have people who are astute in terms of what's going on politically, so they understand what property taxes mean, so they understand, you know, the things the government can do to make a difference in people's lives. So organizing and creating that base, so a part of the work that we're doing as well as other folks. The other thing is that once we develop that base, really start to pressure government to invest in communities. I mean, one of the things that has always boggled my mind is that if you think about what the most lucrative economic development strategy for Baltimore would be, it would be to improve the quality of schools. You know, if you improve the quality of schools, you attract people who are going to come to Baltimore, increase the tax base, you know, more incentive for people to do development, more incentive for people to invest in communities where you have good schools, where you have things like, you know, good homes that are in good shape. The things that for most people sound like altruistic measures that government can take really are fiscally intelligent and are in the best interest of Baltimoreans. And so once we get people to understand that when we lobby government for these things, that it's not just for the people, although that should be our motivation, but it's in their own self-political economic interest, and for all those who are interested in profiting off of it, it's in everyone's interest that the communities are invested in. Because if you look at many of the shootings that happened, that was in the 8th District, in the council district that I was running in. If you look at it, a lot of those were the result of domestic disputes. There were a lot of violence in the 8th District that were outgrowths of domestic disputes. And why do you have that? Because people are in turmoil. People are suffering. People, you know, are stressed out by, you know, the level and magnitude of just blight and you know, destruction that exists in our communities. Invest in them, and you can improve Baltimore in many different ways, not just in the communities, but just overall.
We take a very brief break and come right back with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle at 410-319-8888. Hassan, you're the next caller up. We come back from this break. Stay with us, and don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you that a tradition continues here at WEAA with a second annual WEAA Gospel Grace Benefit Concert featuring the legendary Lady Tremaine Hawkins. Also performing will be the Morgan State University Choir. Sunday, October 30th, 6 p.m. at the Murphy Fine Arts Center. Ticket information at Ticketmaster.com, Ticketmaster Outlets, or at 410-547-SEAT, S-E-A-T. Presented by the Morgan MBA Program and Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are joined in studio by three of the leaders of a beautiful struggle. How's that? the leaders of a beautiful struggle. Dave Von Love is president of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, who ran for city council in this last election. Shauna Murray is vice president of outreach for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Deverick Murray is vice president of programming. 410-319-8888. Hassan, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how you doing, man?
Good, man. It says Hassan Giordano.
Yes, sir. Always a pleasure. You know, I don't call in much. Just like to listen, but I just had to really give big ups and honor to this group of individuals you have on here tonight. I've had the pleasure of knowing Davon and Adam and pretty much the entire Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle for some time now. I was just reading today an Urbanite article that people should pick up that's about them.
This is an Urbanite radio story. That's why we're doing it. That's one of the reasons we're doing it.
Okay, and that was wonderful. This discussion is wonderful, Mark, as well. And, from their Freedom Forums that I went to during the summer at Coppin on education, and Mark, there was no political people there. There was one person on the panel, one mayoral candidate there. That was it. And I think at times that discourages young people. I know way back in the day when I was a part of the youth empowerment movement, we've had Algebra Project, Peer-to-Peer, and Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle are really carrying on their mantle. But that part of the disconnection with the elected officials or with the business type really discourages a lot of young people, but I don't think that they need to be, because what Davon did this summer and what a lot of these young people, Mark, did this summer was we've seen an influx of younger candidates that ran. You mentioned Shannon Sneed and Brandon Scott elected over there in the second district, Nick Mosby and Devon Brown, 21. And that right there, that impact, and I just wrote about it in the Examiner this morning, was the biggest impact, in my opinion, beyond the low turnout. There's a low voter turnout. I blame myself as well as others, but I blame me for not going out there like Davon said, is really getting out there and doing the hard work of getting the people to the polls. Created sites and tried to get people involved, did interviews, but I could have did more, in my opinion. But these young people did a lot in just turning themselves out and getting involved with the process and getting their peers involved. And that's one of the biggest parts of the legislation that we put through the council that now goes to the ballot in November, Mark, which will lower the age from 21 to 18 for them to become involved with campaigns in Baltimore City at a younger age, to get them more involved at a younger age, to be productive individuals. Like these, I'm getting tired of people saying, "Oh, son, they're too young. How can they hold office?" And I see people like Davon and Adam and the leaders who can articulate issues better than most of the individuals that we have elected to office today, Mark. And you know this. Well, a lot of individuals that they can just, debate with at any time, any place, and know the issues a lot better than others.
Let me ask the panel to respond. Because what you just said, Hassan, is a it's a very real issue that we have to bring on the airwaves here about lowering the not just the voting age, but lowering the ability, the age for people to run for office to 18. The question I want to have for the panel is, look, let's say that passes, and people are already voting down, and people can already vote at 18, right? And part of the reason people can vote at 18 because during the Vietnam War, that's what we fought for. We figured if you can go off and fight in the jungles of Nam, then you might as well have a beer and vote, maybe all at the same time. So well, that's illegal. But the question is, so that happens, but that in and of itself doesn't motivate young people to get involved, nor to get them to vote, nor to organize on their own behalf or the behalf of the larger society. Because young people can't do it alone. But so what do you say to that? So it's lowered. Let's say we win. Let's say that we win and that people can actually run for office 18 if they so desire. So that, what does that mean?
I mean, I think that the issue, the substance of the issue that Hassan is getting at with the issue of lowering the age to run is that, and this is something I experienced through the campaign, a lot of our elders, for various reasons, don't have faith in young people, for various reasons. And that's the reason why you don't have a lot of young people getting involved. I mean, there are a bunch of other things that, that keep young people from getting involved in the process. But a lot of it has to do with it when a lot of young people step up to try to make a difference. There are lots of elders who don't believe that young people have the capacity, nor the desire, nor are capable of being effective. And in my case, which I thought was the most remarkable, I mean, you know, this isn't me, you know, saying this per se, but others have said to me that I know issues better than many of those who are in elected office, you know, and could talk about those issues in depth and talk about them with a level of sophistication that people would want in an elected office. But unfortunately, I think there are elements of our community that are not interested in young people stepping up and being in those leadership positions. A part of it has to do with the fact that there are people who have been in those positions for a long time. They've developed their own cliques, their own little groups, and so they maintain hegemony in those certain places. There are lots of reasons for that, but I appreciate what Hassan is doing because I think it's at least symbolic in the notion that we believe enough in our young people to give them a chance to do something like that. So if they choose to,
no, I mean I think that it's a legitimate argument for people 18 years of age to be able to run for office. I think that there's a legitimate argument for that particular position. No question. Well, at least in my book. Maybe you all disagree at 410-319-8888. You can let us know. But young people, younger people, have always been involved at the forefront of struggles. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about it. I mean, Fred Hampton was barely 30 years old when
19.
He was 19 when mm-hmm. he was murdered by the police. No, he was older than 19.
He had just turned 20.
Because he had just come back from, he'd gone to Vietnam and come back. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. And you know, both King and Malcolm were 39 when they died. And when you look at their faces, you can see that they were young when they died, mm-hmm. right? So, and people have always been the forefront of that. The people who were in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. we were all teenagers or in our 20s. So people, the young are always at the forefront of these things. But it's not always a generational thing. I mean, that's who pushes, but it's a much larger societal question. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the question is, how do you as young thinkers, activists, radicals in this community, for want of a better word, you don't mind that? Let me throw that out. that's not a negative statement,
right?
So what do you do? What do you do to change what you see in front of you? What are your thoughts about how you change what you see in front of you?
Well, most importantly, I think, you know, Davon approached me years ago, about 4 years ago, and just so that everybody knows, like, this is not something that we thought about yesterday.
No, you've been doing this.
Saying? Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, the debate team, Davon running for office, is we are in year four or year three and a half of a 4 or 5 year plan that we discussed every day in college, every night. You know, when we get out of class, we done homework. We talking about this for 4 or 5 hours. What I think young people need to do specifically, because I myself, you know, I think, it's just like Davon said, it's a great gesture to say at 18 you can get a part of the process, right? And some elders say y'all not ready. I agree with that. On both sides of the issue, I think that what young people have to do is something that I did, because I know for a fact I wasn't ready to run for office. I'm 22 years old. I am not ready to hold a position in office in Baltimore City. But what I am ready to do is to work day and night, every hour that I can spend working behind Davon, because I have chosen him as my leader. You know what I'm saying? So I think that what the young people mainly have to do is to pick, you know what I'm saying, somebody who they find a valiant work, somebody who they find who puts in great effort, and somebody who's a thinker with a vision, and to get behind that person or those group of people and to dedicate their time and their energy into whatever the plan is. You know what I'm saying? Oftentimes, we'll see a young man on the corner. He got the fresh shoes that we want. He got the girls that we want. So we'll say, you know, whatever he doing, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be with him so I can get what I want. So when we see young people
in any form or facet, Baltimore Algebra Project, Peer to Peer, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, when we see those people doing the things to changing the communities, that's when it's time to give up, you know, going to the movies on Saturday, be at the Freedom Forum. That's when it's time to give up, you know, whatever it is you're doing after school that's not extracurricular and come and be at an LBS meeting, you know. So that's what I think that's important. Like, what I think it happens is that you have people that, you know, even us sitting in this room, we have a vision, we have a plan, we have an understanding. But, you know, no matter how many people we have right now, it's not enough. You know, we can have 1,000 people right now. We need 2,500. So I think the most important thing that the young people can do, especially, you feel me, from the ages of 14 to 20, is to get behind some youth movement in the city. Because I can tell you right now, all the youth movements in the city are connected. LBS will not stand to not have a youth organization working and working alone. So we all working together. But get behind one of them so that, you know, you can put your two cents in, your sweat, your blood, your tears, and that's how we really going to get things started.
And I think it's really important for us to begin to kind of express to our young people that there's value in experience. You know what I mean? A lot of our elders kind of look at us and think, well, you haven't really experienced anything. And I think from reading the article in the Urbanite about many of us and, you know, a lot of the perspectives that we might have, there's value in experience. So that young person that feels like, you know, because I know I used to feel like, you know, who am I? You know, this young person, I haven't really done anything. But the truth is that, you know, I've done a lot, you know, and I've experienced many of the things that many of the politicians, many people in the community couldn't even imagine, you know. And I think that if that young people will begin to trust in themselves and their ability to do what Devrick just said, if they find value in the experiences they have and recognize that they have the ability to critically think about solutions for those experiences.
410-319-8888. We have with us here Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. You just heard Shauna Murray, one of the vice presidents, Dave, and before that, Devrick Murray, who is another one of the vice presidents, and Davon Love, who is president of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. So, and where do you think you will go now? I mean, what is up? The election's done. That consumed a lot of your time. And a lot of y'all, everybody's time, right, in this election. And I wonder what your analysis is of why you think it didn't succeed. I mean, in the sense of winning. Not that it didn't succeed. In the sense of winning. Because I've run a lot of campaigns that didn't win that I thought were a success in another level. and so what now?
I mean, I think in terms of the campaign, it was successful in the sense that it really exposed me and my peers to folks that may not have ever seen us and heard the things that we were working on. And so a lot of people, even people that didn't vote for me, were really impressed and were supportive. Both of the other two major candidates in the race were both very supportive, both of them very encouraging and were interested in working with me and my peers in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, I think in that sense it was success. In terms of why we didn't win, I think it just has to do with the fact that politics in this city are entrenched. You know, they're very deep networks that run very deep, and we just haven't had the time to really get into those networks to be able to, at least in people's mind, be seen as a legitimate political
candidate. So when you look at what goes on in a city like this or in any community, and you see rec centers closing and you see the what happens to so many young people, and with the issues of poverty that are so deep in the city, incarceration of black people, especially of young black men in this community. I mean, so what do you say to people? What's your organizing ideas when you talk to people about what can be done and what should be done? And how you approach those issues?
Well, first I'd just like to say something, a small thing about what we just said. Under no circumstance did we lose. You know what I'm saying? This election was such a win for us. We have, just from a programming perspective, I have learned so much being a field coordinator and being on the ground all day, every day, dealing with the campaign. I have learned so much that I'm almost guaranteeing our Freedom Forums will be 100% better. You know what I'm saying? Our general body meetings will be 100% better because of things that I learned while campaigning. It's going to take us, you know, through the roof as far as organizing is concerned. And secondly, so, you know, we're going to be able to be
in the streets as if we're campaigning, right? We're going to be able to be in the streets talking to people, finding out what people need, and actually being somebody to be there to be able to touch and talk to. And, you know, the language that I use all the time, I spent a lot of time in Emerson Village, and I talk about it because it was so important. You know, people kept mistaking me for Davon. They said I looked like him. But, you know, everything, one common phrase that I heard was, you know, this the young dude who going to save the hood. You know what I'm saying? And one of the things, like, people want that savior, that messiah type of person to come.
But let me just interrupt you right there. Uh-huh. Because one of the things, and Sean, you can jump right in, but I'm only interrupting you at this point because I think you've made a statement here. The problem is, isn't that part of the problem?
And that's where I would go from what Derek is saying, is they want that. And so what I say to them is, you are part of that. You know what I'm saying? That's why we created the Freedom Forums, to give people in the community the opportunity to become more comfortable with the topics that we're talking about, to begin to look at their own personal experience and be able to parallel that with what's happening politically. And from then on, you know, they come to one, they're going to come to the rest of them because they're the bomb, right? So they come, and then we begin to develop the kind of relationships so that they become a part, they become an integral part, because we encourage them to think about what role they can play. Never is it that a person just comes and we're like, all right, you know, have yourself some pretzels and some water and just sit and watch. No, we encourage everyone to come again, come to our meetings, you know, so that they can be an integral part of the next steps. So everyone wants that, and it's great that we have someone, you know, that everyone believes in. You know, and that should be their model, you know, that's a magnet. All right. And then I'm just going to pull you the rest of the way, because you need to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and identify your own self as a leader. Yeah. And I think that's where we are.
And I think one of the most important parts is that our leadership style, Davon leadership style, is to create leaders, not to get people to follow. You know, so I think that's the most important part. So the best part about them wanting that messiah is that it'll be, you know, people to teach them the way to be their own messiah, to be their own savior.
410-319-8888. What do you think of Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle? These young folks you're hearing, young because they're younger than I am. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on that? And I'd like to hear what you think about it in response to what they're saying. 410-319-8888. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, I suppose, when I hear what you're saying, can't say I'm pointing at Deborah. When I hear what you're saying, I think of, I was thinking of that moment of King. And Martin Luther King would always deflect that, because he knew that there was no Messiah in a movement. Mm-hmm. And he knew that it wasn't him. And he also knew he didn't make the movement. The movement made him. That the Montgomery bus boycott created Martin Luther King. You know, he was there, but it created him. Yeah, it was the regular people on the street in the community that pushed, that made him what he was, that made him the symbol of something much bigger.
Yeah, I mean, all of us are students of history, and one thing that has been really helpful for us in understanding the nature, the type of organizing needs to happen, is to understand some of the mythologies that have been passed down to us by popular culture and by people oversimplifying history. So, for instance, I mean, one of the analogies that I used to use during the campaign, you know, when people would say, you know, I'm too young, you know, in 1955, when King was a part of the Montgomery bus boycott, he was pushed out as a leader. He was 25 years old. You know, and a lot of people don't know that King, when he was 25 years old, he was designated the leader, right? But he didn't do much of the administrative work. You know, he wasn't the one doing much of the organizing. That's something that he learned on the process. And in fact, it's interesting. A lot of people talk about King as if back then most of the people, black people in this country and others, were supportive of King. You know, that he was the messiah people see him as today. I think the messiah syndrome is really a symptom of something that is more post-civil rights in terms of the collective consciousness and psychology of the people in our communities, more than it is about the past and what people were looking for in the past. Because if we really understand history, we understand there were a lot of black preachers and clergy people who weren't supportive of King, you know, and thought that he was too radical, thought that he was mixing religion and politics in a way that for them was uncomfortable. And understanding that helps us to understand then why it is that we have a faith community that to some extent isn't as involved in the process of empowerment as they should be. Understanding that as an extension of a historical trend is important for our own advocacy.
This question that came in from Phil Leaf, actually, and the question is, what was the most important positive support they received in helping develop their new strategy, their strategy?
Their strategy, meaning?
Our strategy, I guess.
Politically? I guess politically. In campaign.
I mean, I would say the biggest resource, I mean, the stuff that we did in debate in terms of using the Black Liberation Movement as a resource for understanding how to navigate the process. A lot of people come to us and they say, why are you so young? You know that, you know, that you're attentive to that. I just think that's really the biggest contribution is really rigorously understanding history, understanding the nature of political movements, understanding what was effective and what wasn't. And that's something that we stress a lot is being effective. We don't want to be another one of these organizations that does stuff from time to time.
And looks really nice doing it, but doesn't work.
Exactly.
and I would argue a part of that resource or a big resource that we had were that we, a lot of people that we can go and talk to and really sit up underneath our elders who have experienced things to really say, what's this, what's that, why did this happen? And then we use our own intellect and our own, discernment to be able to understand how we should act in these moments. We have a lot of great people that we can call, that we go talk to, we set up meetings with, that pour into us so much, and we listen and we take that time. And like Davon said, a part of the debate skills, once you get all of this evidence and all of this words sitting in front of you, us being able to parse through that and make it make sense for Baltimore City, make it make sense for 2011, and make it make sense for what we see on a day-to-day basis. I just think that one of the most important things was, having those people to go and ask questions to.
And one thing I got to say really quickly, I think is really important, is that the thing about Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle that's different is that we're a youth organization that isn't dictated to by some foundation or by some particular individual that tells us what to do. And I think too often we have a lot of organizations that are dictated to by foundations that fund certain programs that won't fund others, or that are dictated to by certain people who have a political vision and that try to indoctrinate, people to do and behave the way they do. We're independent in the sense that, we do our own discernment. We have resources of people who are elders, like Devrick said, who we listen to and provide us guidance. But we're independent in the sense that we're unbought. You know what I'm saying? Nobody tells us what to do. No one, stops
we
our
fund
funding.
We fund us.
So. On that note, I'm going to thank you all for being here. I like that. We fund us. I like that. Leaders of Beautiful Struggle have been with us in the studio this hour. Davon Love, Shauna Murray, Devrick Murray. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Have a good day.
You too. I want to remind you as we get out of here, we're coming right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org. Our number for information is 1-800-888-8823, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on the University of Maryland Medical System banner. All the information is right there. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about how you can be involved to stop the killing of Troy Davis and also talk a bit about President Barack Obama and what's happening in America. Stay with us. We'll be right back.